Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
All of a sudden, this guy, which is so characteristic of these destructive cults, figures out what the chink in a person's armor is and promises them greatness. You have more light and knowledge than somebody else. You're better than others because God has adopted you into this family that I'm in charge of. Because it isn't about having something cool in a cult. It's having something that nobody else has that is so motivating.
I present you today with my king, Mike King. Mike is a former law enforcement officer who has worked on programs for the FBI and helped police departments across the US in dealing with true crime cases. In his decades on the job, he has uncovered some truly harrowing crimes, and today he's talking about how he helped expose and break up the Zion Society cult. This was a cult led by a proclaimed prophet named Arvin Shreve, who set up a small neighborhood in Utah full of families that would take part in his polygamous sect. The women were expected to have sex with Arvin, and that very sadly included many of the underage girls that he raped over a period of years, until one day, one of the women walked into Mike's office. He tells the story with real vigor and emotion, particularly around the part where he was reunited decades later with the girls that he helped free on the Dr. Phil show. You can find that on YouTube. It's very moving, and you can get Mike's brilliant book, Deceived, an investigative memoir of the Zion Society cult, online. Check out Mike's YouTube channel and podcast, Profiling Evil, where he delves into cult-like behavior. I'm a guest on his channel. That one's coming out mid-July, so don't miss it. I'm talking about that exorcist stuff. Many of you have been in touch, by the way, to pick up on my mispronunciation of the word insidious. I don't know why I thought it was insidious, and I started using it loads as well. But has anyone else pronounced it that way, insidious? Also, are there any other words that you were pronouncing wrong for years and then realized you were doing so? Let me know so I don't feel quite so alone. It reminds me of my appearance on the Jordan Harbinger show. He gets 300,000 listeners a week, to whom all of them I was saying disavow someone of something rather than disabuse them of a notion. You disavow something, but you disabuse someone of something. And I was getting that wrong, and loads of people were listening. But what can you do? You're trying to sound clever and you sound silly in the end. In my defense, when you become a speaker of several languages, yes, I'm showing off, some of your maternal language starts to sound a bit sort of foreign or weird in your own mouth. And so things come out wrong. Anyway, that's my excuse and I'm sticking to it. Coming up on the podcast are episodes with leavers of the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Moonies cults. Rob Manuel's coming on. He's from Fess Hole on Twitter. It's an account where people reveal their secrets, and it's really quite a funny one. So I want to know what he's learned from getting secrets from people for years. And Peter Boghossian, a big name professor in the anti-woke world. He got in trouble recently about some trans ideology stuff at university where he was debating with some young people. I think he stayed very calm in that world. He's not one of the very aggressive people in that world. He's smart and well-spoken, I think. But now you're on the edge with the Zion Society cult and Mike King. Welcome on the edge, Mike. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great, Andrew. It's so good to see you again. I'll tell you, one of the funnest interviews I did was with you, and I just am so excited to be on with you.
Oh, get out of here. I don't believe that. Well, I do, because we did have a lot of fun, didn't we?
We did have fun.
So, yes, we are talking today about this cult that you expose. I've read the book. Unbelievable. Tell us about the book, where people can get it and stuff, and a little bit about your, well, that's about three different questions, isn't it? Tell us, let's start with, let's tell people what you are, because law enforcement, right? Does that mean a police officer? What does law enforcement actually mean?
Yeah, you're right on. I spent 30 years in law enforcement. I started out as a street cop. I loved being a street cop. There's nothing like it to be a patrol officer working graveyard shifts. 1 minute be driving with a Diet Dr. Pepper in your hand, listening to music in the background, and the next minute being in a foot pursuit after a guy that's just shot somebody. I mean, it was an incredible job. It was a job that you went from 0 to 60 in adrenaline on an almost daily basis, but every case was different. And you know, we used to say in the profiling business, we would say, he who is good with a hammer thinks everything is a nail. And the idea for that was that police officers can't get into a mindset that this is what happens in a burglary case or in a domestic violence case, and this is how you handle it. Every stinking one of them is different. And so you walk into it with a completely fresh set of eyes, and you try to understand, how am I going to respond to this? So it was an exciting career from that perspective, because you constantly were on your toes trying to figure out, how am I going to be successful? How can I best advocate for these people? And how can I make sure I come home safely every night?
Yeah, well, that's a really important part, that final part. I mean, how does one go about a job where, you know, you never know if you might come home safely every night, you might be in trouble, and the safety aspects of that? How do you square that with your family, for example?
You know, for me, I had to be a little bit schizophrenic. When I went to work, I wasn't a family person. I was a cop 100%, and all of my focus was intently designed to be successful as a cop, to advocate for people who can't fight for themselves. And I remember as a rookie being taught that police officers are the last line of defense. If you lose, there's nobody else to call. There's nobody else that's going to pick up the pieces. So it doesn't matter if you get punched in the nose, or if you get shot, you keep fighting until your last breath. And if you get that mindset, some call it a warrior mindset. I don't know. I just selfishly called it, I really want to go home at night, and I really want to win, and I don't want bad guys to win. And so you have to have that mindset. But then, for me personally, what I had to do through my faith tradition, with a wife now of 45 years with children, is I had to turn it off when I came home, and I couldn't be a cop at home. I couldn't look at things as a cop would look at them. And so I was not the guy that ever carried a gun off duty or other kinds of things. I came home and I just tried to be a normal Joe. But then, you know, that schizophrenic personality, when it was time to go back to work, especially when I was on the SWAT team and working tactics or working undercover, is you're just 100% invested in doing the job the right way.
Does that even mean if you're going to risk your life, for example? I mean, I'd like to think that, so if I were a police officer or something, I think I would try and do everything I can, even putting myself at risk. But the moment I see, like, okay, that bullet is either going to, or any circumstance that's similar to that, a bullet that's going to either hit me in the head and I'm dead, or this person from the public, that's when I'd be like, well, I'm not going to do that, you know?
you know, I think this is where training becomes so important. And you think about things that you've done repetitively. The theory behind training is that when things go down the toilet, you don't have time to really think. You've already put in your mind what's required in order to use lethal force, what's required to physically subdue somebody, what's required to get down on your knees and hug a little kid. I mean, you've kind of worked through all of those things, and you've said, when these elements happen, when these kinds of things occur, then I can do these things. These are my options. And so the idea that you really think through the process happened long before you did it. I remember one time when I discharged my weapon at a suspect. There was no thought at that, Andrew. I mean, it was immediate. Those decisions had been made years earlier on the range. What a police officer needs to try to do is take advantage of what we call cover and concealment. If you're approaching an area, do you have adequate cover? Do you have adequate concealment so that when things do go down the toilet, you have that extra fraction of a second to say, do I do it now? Do I lean on my training, or do I hold off for a second and see if this threat is really existing? And so it really does boil down to training. You can't, in the middle of a gun battle or a fist fight, say, holy cow, I wish I'd have spent a little more time at the range, or I wish I'd have done a few more push-ups so that physically I could subdue this guy. There's no time for it then. It all happens months and years earlier.
Is that then, and I don't want to go too far into this because it's not what this episode is about, but could that also be responsible for sometimes some officers being a little trigger happy, particularly that there's that sort of reputation of officers in the US sometimes shooting when it might not have been necessary? Is that the downside of that sort of innate reaction?
You know, I think there are anomalies where officers make poor decisions. Most of the time, whether people like it or not, those shootings are justified. Officers are doing the right thing. I get so irritated when I hear my friends from the UK or around the world, Australia or others, that are saying, oh, you guys are shooting everybody. Well, you know what, Andrew? If you point a gun at a cop, expect to get shot. Don't expect me as a police officer to say, oh, I wonder if Andrew's having a bad day and really doesn't mean this, or I wonder if that's a play gun and not a real gun. There's some responsibility that has to go back on a community for the actions that they have, and I think we're afraid to talk about that right now. There's this sense of beat up on the cops mentality right now, defund, that we're now seeing go back to maybe we need to refund. You know, this pendulum, I hope, will swing back and level again. And usually it does. I've never seen it as intense as it is today. But you know what, Andrew, if a guy pulls a knife on me and he's within 10 feet, he's as lethal as a guy pointing a gun at me. And I guess I just keep going back to this idea of, what do you think's going to happen if you point a gun at a cop?
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't do. I stay very calm and still. Not that I don't think I've ever spoken to a cop or police officer on duty. Whenever I have, I think they've been very nice to me. So there you go. I'm certainly not a defund the police person. I mean, I'm very happy that there are people. You know, one of my favorite speeches is from that film. It's not about the police. It's about the army. But you know, A Few Good Men. Did you see that with Jack Nicholson?
The You Can't Handle the Truth?
Yeah. Yeah, that was great because that was like, I was in my sort of political innocence or youth at that point because I was like 17 or something. And the idea at that age for a lot of people is really attractive. This idea of like, screw the police and screw the military. They're just invading and killing everyone. And, you know, there were good and bad sides of everything. So, you know, I respect that. But that speech of just like, you know, that Tom Cruise character was so arrogant, the lawyer, and he's so annoying in that. If you watch it back now, I think it's dated badly because he just comes across, he's supposed to be the good guy, the protagonist, and he's really annoying. And Jack Nicholson's character responding like, look, you want the truth? Here's the truth. Like you get to sleep at night beneath your lovely roof and in your bed and stuff and not have to think about all this stuff. I have to like employ tactics that you find, you know, insatisfactory or indecent or whatever. It's not easy, but I'm very thankful that I have people like the military and the police. Just, you know, I don't want to get beaten up and stuff. And I guess sometimes there are those. Sometimes there are things where there have been examples, I think, where they, maybe it turned out the person didn't really pose a threat or whatever. But I mean, how many police officers are there across the United States, right? And it's just such a tough one. There's so many people, you're going to get some who do things wrong in any career.
Yeah, you know, and this is an interesting difference between the states and many other places around the world. Is in the United States, there are like 18,000 police departments. There are 870,000-ish police officers who are working the streets. That's 18,000 different chiefs of police who think they know everything for their community, or maybe even more globally, who knows. But the 18,000 different people making decisions, 18,000 different police data systems. And so we have a real problem in the States with what I call the three C's: cooperating, communicating, and coordinating efforts. We're getting better at it. Technology is helping us get better at it. All of these challenges that law enforcement's going through are not negative. It's important that we have these dialogues and talk about police use of force, and at what point do you turn on the mechanism. I'm sitting in San Francisco right now with 500 of the brightest police chiefs and commanders from across the United States in a meeting that we hold. Usually it's 60 police departments. This one is spread much bigger for this particular thing. But we're talking about all kinds of issues, and we're looking at things like the taser, and at what point does the taser become part of this. We're looking at a new technology called the wrap, which is a bolo that swings and wraps around the legs and can help to control a suspect. But the bottom line is police officers are facing high capacity weapons, heavy duty weapons, at a rate today so much greater than I ever faced on the street. And I faced a lot of guns in my career.
And also, people who want to defund the police, well, you know, this cult that you exposed is just one of the many examples in your career of people that would probably still be going if we didn't have police. So tell me a little bit about this. What are they called? The Cult of Zion?
Yeah, they were called the Zion Society cult. And you asked earlier about the book, and I'm sure we'll get to that. But the book that I wrote is called Deceived, an investigative memoir of the Zion Society cult. And folks can find it on Amazon, and or they can go to profilingevil.com and order hardbound versions.
It's a great read.
Oh, well, thank you. And it's just so kind of you to talk about this case. It's really interesting because this was a group that is different than most groups. Now, most experts would suggest that at any time around the world, there's about 5,000, 6,000 cults that are operating. Many of those cults, especially the bigger ones that we read about and that we see on TV, generally they organize and they build their compounds kind of off the grid, away from the public view, where they can kind of do the things they do. This group was really different because they built in an urban area their compound right under the nose of people, and they were successful for about 10 years until the morning of the raid when we broke this group up. Now, there were lots of ghost stories, but they were pulling it off.
It's really, really fascinating and horrible as well. So how did you first come across them? Tell me about when Erin Anderson came into your office.
Yeah, this is the craziest thing. So we'd heard these ghost stories. I mean, I'd driven these neighborhoods so many times, looking kind of as one of those curious onlookers of things that were going on. As a police officer, I was looking at the area wondering what on earth's going on. The local news media was sharing stories from estranged husbands or other people who had disenfranchised themselves from the cult. And they were all just whack-a-noodle stories. I mean, it was just crazy what was being talked about. But law enforcement could never put a criminal act to some of the allegations. It wasn't against the law for people to go through divorces. It wasn't against criminal law for parents to be estranged and fighting over the custody of children. All those kinds of cases we kept pushing back to the civil courts and saying, good luck working it out. But all of a sudden one day, I was actually working an undercover sting operation for the community that I worked in, and it was a community of about 300,000 people, and we had a number of officers assigned to this task force that I was leading, and we were looking at stolen vehicles, and we were buying stolen cars and selling them, trying to work our way up the crime ladder to get to the real kingpins of the organization. So I was consumed, and it was a great job. It was the kind of police work that young cops like. I mean, you're kicking down doors and you're doing real police work. And one day I walked into the county attorney's office, and the receptionist said, "Hey, I need you to talk to a woman over here. She's been waiting for some time to talk to an investigator." And frankly, I was the bottom rung on the ladder, I think, Andrew, because she's like, I don't have anybody else. can you talk to this woman? So I went over, and she, I just noticed this was a beautiful young woman. She was flipping through a magazine. She confidently looks up, stands up, shakes my hand, and says, "Hey, I'm Aaron Anderson, and I've been involved in a cult that's sexually abusing children. Do you have a minute to talk to me?" And, I mean, talk about the wind getting pulled out of your sails. My mind was racing 100 miles an hour as I sat there trying to act like I hear this kind of a thing every day and thinking, what do I do next? Because I wasn't a sex crimes investigator. I was running a property crimes task force.
I suppose if you act like you're shocked, she might close up and be like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be saying this kind of thing.
Exactly. And that's the key to actually interviewing people, is to just remain this receptacle of empathetic understanding that wants to just say, tell me your story. And so I took her back to my office, and I pulled this dusty old cassette recorder. And for some of the younger people, you know, they'll probably laugh about that, but I put a brand new cassette tape in, and I pushed play and record, and she started to tell her story. And what I thought might be just a couple of minutes where I could gather a little bit of information to turn over to somebody who was really good at these kinds of things, it turned into a 2 or 3 hour discussion that was absolutely mind-blowing as she unloaded hundreds of counts of rape and sexual assault of children.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Did she, a sort of double question here, did she implicate herself? And at what point is someone held culpable for their actions when they've been indoctrinated into a cult?
You know, it's interesting because I actually read her rights. And in the United States, we have something called the Miranda warning, which is a warning that says, listen, if you say something, we can use that against you. So really think about what we're going to say. When I started this interview, I had this gut feeling that this wasn't just a, hey, tell me a little story and I'll pass you on to somebody else. But of course, with that kind of a declaration of I've been involved in a cult and we're sexually abusing kids, I made sure that I advised her of that Miranda right. And it's something you memorize when you're in the police academy. But you also carry a little card in your pocket that is word for word. And when it is really a serious thing, you pull that card out and you read from it, because you don't want some defense attorney later saying, oh, you forgot this part, so we're going to throw out all of the testimony.
That's, you have the right to remain silent. Is that what that is that we're hearing in Hollywood movies?
Exactly. I mean, think about those. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to an attorney. If you'd like an attorney but you can't afford one, we're going to appoint one to represent you. Now, Andrew, do you understand that you have the right to not talk to me? I mean, you have to be really specific, because yeah, you just so don't want these things challenged and you don't want to give them a way out, especially when it involves something as serious as this. So she agrees. She agrees to tell me things that, knowing she's implicating herself in this thing, could send her to prison and send her to prison for a long time. And that really shows you the amount of guilt that she was feeling as a participant in this organization. Now, some have questioned over the years, Was she manipulating the system? I could care less, Andrew, whether she was or not. Maybe she was hoping she could get a better deal by coming in. And she certainly did, because she was the linchpin to opening this case up and giving us the ability to prosecute. But yeah, that's kind of the game we play.
And so what did she reveal to you? What was going on with a man called Arvin in his sort of little neighborhood of homes?
You know, this guy was a man who feigned that he was a prophet of God. He feigned, like many of these cult leaders, that he was the chosen one who had been given this assignment to lead others and to teach others and all those wacky things that you hear from these people. And this is something that really troubles me about cults and cult characteristics and behaviors, is this lack of transparency that occurs in destructive cults. And I want to break it off because, I grew up like in the Dallas Cowboys. That, in essence, is a cult. To us over here, that's real football. You guys have different opinions about that. But
I have the same opinion about my support of football or soccer, as you call it, being very, it's the one thing where I let myself be really, really tribal. I like allow it to come out.
Yeah, isn't that something? And yet you do it in a very transparent way. It's transparent. It's not destructive in nature. Now, there are always wackos that go a little too far on things, you know, but that doesn't mean that that's the guy that's painting his face. That's what we're talking about, are destructive cults where criminal events happen as a result of that cult. And this guy Arvin was running a cult that was like that. He was smart enough to recruit women that he believed were in vulnerable positions. And Erin was one of those women. She had just gone through a divorce and separation. She was pregnant with her second child. She had a child. She wanted to get away from what she felt was a marriage that wasn't working, and had no means to do that, had no formal education, was working an hourly wage job, and was faced with the prospect of living in substandard conditions, possibly not being able to feed her children, facing a future of unknowns. And all of a sudden, this guy, which is so characteristic of these destructive cults, figures out what the chink in a person's armor is and promises them greatness. You have more light and knowledge than somebody else. You're better than others because God has adopted you into this family that I'm in charge of. All these kind of wacky beliefs that set people apart. Because it isn't about having something cool in a cult. It's having something that nobody else has that is so motivating.
It's so scary what was going on there. And so it was to do with, do you think, this is a question that I get asked about my exorcist guy a lot, and I never know the answer. And it's, do you think he really thought he was a prophet of God, a mouthpiece of a deity, or did he want an excuse to be able to have sex with children and other, all sorts of women and polygamy and all that stuff?
You know, I think it goes both ways. And a lot of people are suggesting that many of these cult leaders are actually schizophrenics who have these beliefs that they somehow are in effect these great people of purpose out there. So I think that's a possibility, but I don't think it's probable in Arvin's case. And I'll tell you why, is during the investigation, I uncovered that he was nothing more than a predatory pedophile who built a religion around his personal lusts and belief system. And I think it was in part to justify the guilt that he felt, knowing that he was violating societal standards, heavenly standards. He was a criminal and a predatory pedophile who twisted religion to somehow justify it in the eyes of others. And you know, if you think about it, if you can use the voodoo of religion to control people, that's the perfect thing. Because, you know, I grew up in a family of faith. I have a strong faith tradition. there are things that I believe that I tangibly cannot put my hands on and say, here's proof. But in my soul, I know something's true.
Is that a Mormon background?
And I am a Latter-day Saint, yes. And I have this really cool opportunity in my responsibilities in the Latter-day Saint faith. My wife and I, we every week by assignment visit another faith tradition and get to know the pastor or the imam or the rabbi. And we've been doing this for nearly 9 years. And I find that this is consistent across all faith traditions, that faith traditions are called that because of a real key point, faith, this believing something that you can't see, but you know it's true. So if I can convince people that they are doing God's will, I mean, how powerful is that? Because God trumps local law. God trumps anything that might be considered something awry. And that's why when we look at really mainstream religions that are transparent in what they do versus in this particular case where we're talking about religious cults, that transparency is so important. That we believe and follow the laws of the land is so important. In my faith tradition, the Latter-day Saints, when the Latter-day Saint Church began and they started practicing polygamy, they were trying to mimic things that happened in the Old Testament and that has happened throughout history in many faith traditions. But when the United States Congress said, it's against the law, they said, we also have to obey the laws of the land. And that's why in 1890, the Latter-day Saint leadership said, no more polygamy. It while it might be something that's higher level and God supported in Old Testament and other times, it ain't happening today because it's against the laws of the land. And that to me is really significant.
It's a funny thing, polygamy, because I think Mormons got a lot of criticism for, I mean, I know it's not legal anymore, but people think it is, don't they? So they got a lot of flack for that. And I sort of, I don't know, I didn't give it much thought really. And then I thought, just while I was reading your book, I guess theoretically, is there such a big problem with polygamy? I guess the problem is it often ends up sort of a man who is taking advantage of women that he enslaves or whatever. But there's a lot of people who might love more than one person. And maybe, I guess it's against the law, isn't it? But I'm just wondering out loud now ethically such a bad thing. It's not something that would interest me. I think one person's enough to drive you mad, isn't it? But, you know.
You know, it's a concept that I don't understand. Religiously, I understood what happened anciently. I know in our own faith tradition what happened historically in our church. But I know what has happened since then with the groups who were excommunicated from the Latter-day Saint faith who continued to practice polygamy. I investigated them for years after I left this particular investigation that we're talking about. I took over a role leading the polygamy and the ritual crime unit for the Attorney General in the state of Utah. We investigated hundreds and hundreds of counts. And in many cases, these leaders that were self-proclaimed perverted over time. And there were legitimate allegations of child sexual abuse, of multiple brides, of abusing the public assistance system. And so what I did as a police officer is I said, you know what, this isn't a religious matter to me. These are violations of criminal law. And when we violate criminal law, that's where law enforcement can step in. It's against the law to sexually assault adult women and force them through guys or anything else to have sex with you. It's against the law to sexually assault children. It's against the law to lie and get welfare and other public assistance. And so what I would say to the investigators that I worked with is, instead of getting drawn into the tunnel and all of the emotion of this, focus on what we're good at, violation of criminal law. And let all of this religion and everything else be something that people yap about in court, but it doesn't change the fact that you knew that it was against the law to rape children and you chose to do it anyway.
So again, going back to what I was hinting at before, I'm interested to know just legally, if you're pressured or you feel you were brainwashed by a cult to do bad things, so where does the buck stop with you legally?
You're still responsible if you do it. Now, you can argue that I should have some mitigating factors. We're seeing it right now. I don't know if you remember the case of Charles Manson back in 65. And there were these three women. They called them Charlie's Devils that murdered people for him. One just was given an opportunity for the possibility of parole. She's been in prison for nearly 50 years. And they're saying, well, you know what? It's been a long time, and she didn't know what she was doing, and maybe we should parole her. Well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to be doing a video on this because I am incensed. This woman still was charged with 7 different crimes of murder. She still murdered a person. She stabbed a woman. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, there are consequences to things that we do. And the fact that you happen to get hoodwinked and believe some wacko that says he speaks for God isn't a reason to say you're not responsible. You still, because, you know, they still try to avoid detection. They still lie to police. It would be really different. Have you watched at all the Chad Daybell and Lori Daybell case in America? The mother, the cult mother who with her new husband murdered her 2 children and is currently facing murder charges. She is saying, you know what, I just, you know, was a little bit schizophrenic. Well, you know what, you avoided telling police that you did this. She believed her kids were zombies, according to all reports. And so that authorized her to execute them and have them buried in the backyard of her brand new lover husband. She avoided police discussion. She didn't participate in trying to find him. And so what I say is she understood what societal demands were, what the rules were, and she chose to violate them anyway. If she was truly crazy, she would have been on the rooftop screaming, "I killed another zombie. Thank goodness I'm here." You know, that's a big difference between, "I'm not going to talk to you. I'm not, oh, my kids are staying with their aunt in a state 1,000 miles away." Those are big differences. And that's why it's so important that police officers not get sucked into the emotion of ritualism and everything else, but they focus on the elements of a crime and prove those elements. Because when you do, it takes away all the gas, takes away all the emotion.
Well, I've had people on here, like forensic science, you know, forensic anthropologists and things like that, criminal whatever's they're called, the official names of them. And they've spoken about how a lot of people try and get off on, you know, like the insanity thing. Oh, it was insanity. And she says that's not necessarily a good thing to do because you're going to end up in an even more horrible or equally horrible place and possibly never let out again until you can prove you're sane, which is often impossible. So it's a sort of, it's a mistake that we see, you know, we see it in movies a lot. People are, no, I was clinically insane. Well, now you're going to go to an even worse place.
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting angle. And in many states in the United States, we have these insanity, I'm not guilty by reason of insanity. We're seeing more and more states say insanity isn't going to be a defense. If you're crazy, we're going to put you in a mental institution until you are deemed competent, but you're still going to face the fiddler. You're going to still face a court and have to say, here's what happened and were you guilty or not. I go back to just the simplistic side of it. And that, frankly, Andrew, is if you're understanding what societal demands are, what the laws are, and you choose to violate them anyway, you can say anything else you want, but you understood and you chose to do it. Whether you believe that they were a voodoo witch monster or you were just plain mad at them, it doesn't change the elements of the case. You chose to take a life. You chose to sexually assault someone. you chose to steal from somebody. And so with that, there should be accountability.
I'll just clarify that Mike is speaking to a hypothetical person and not me. I didn't do any of those things. What going back to the cult, what were some of Arvin's quirks and beliefs? I mean, one that stood out for me was that he made everyone eat licorice. That was a weird one.
You know, some of the kids, now, of course, this is really kind of an amazing thing. This case, we ended up convicting 12 people in the case. It took 2 years to get through the court system, those 12 people. And back then, children were forced to testify in what we call preliminary hearings or an initial fact-finding hearing. And in those hearings, there wasn't a jury, so these defense attorneys could just really be brutal to these little children. And these kids were having to testify over and over again about the abuses that happened. We eventually just decided that we needed to stop prosecuting people because we continued to drag this thing on. Whether it was the right decision or not, I don't know. But along the way, we realized that there were so many pieces of collateral injury that happened that weren't rectified. And it was years later until the kids, I went 30 years, Andrew, without talking to the victims of this crime. And we rescued 32 children. It wasn't until those kids actually reached out to me and frankly, a little bit of prodding from Phil McGraw, Dr. Phil, to write the book, because the kids kept asking for it because I didn't want to revisit this thing. There were too many ugly memories even for me, and I wasn't the victim.
Yeah, we should stay with that because that Dr. Phil scene's quite amazing. For anyone who hasn't seen that, you can find that on YouTube, can't you? You went on Dr. Phil to talk about this, and you didn't know that he had brought the children, you know, decades later, the ones that you'd saved there. You looked very emotional. You're very tearful and everything. It made me tearful to watch.
Yeah, I was a basket case. Yeah, I walked out on stage and there were a group of these women now in their 40s. They were 10 to 15 years old at the time they were being sexually assaulted. And these children were not being sexually assaulted once or twice. They were victimized hundreds and hundreds of times by every adult member of that group that was participating in the sexual assaults. So male or female, they were being forced to sometimes multiple times a day be engaged in horrendous sex acts. When I walked out and saw these beautiful women 30 years later, I mean, I just fell apart.
God, it's such a fantastic scene to watch. So, and I mean, you made that difference in their lives. And it's not many of us who in our jobs and our daily lives that can say that we really changed the course of history for these people. So yeah, it was really an amazing, amazing thing. yeah, I mean, what was that? What happened then? Because I watched the book. Did they end up talking to you? Have you stay in touch with a lot of them now?
You know, it's interesting. Some of them have never had relationships with their families since that event, because the people who were charged with loving and caring for them, even in many cases their parents, were the ones who threw them on this sacrificial altar of abuse. And so some of them actually looked to me and my wife as more parent figures than their own parents. They call for advice. They call to share accomplishments that they have. They stop by the house now. I mean, I went 30 years without talking to these kids, and I keep calling them kids. These are, you know, moms and successful people. But here's a couple of things that happened in that first meeting. We got them together to talk about what their lives had been like, and their lives were very similar in the lack of trust that they have in religion, for instance. Most have either abandoned or changed religious beliefs or have no faith in religion because of what religion did to them at that age. That was a consistent characteristic. Most of these children left the cult with only a third grade education. Some were lucky enough to make it to high school after the raid that we conducted. So they went through their life working hourly wage jobs. One in particular, became a stripper and worked the stripper circuit from Albuquerque, New Mexico, all the way over to Los Angeles, and eventually started to find her way. They tried to get educations, but they were good at reading. They learned how to read scripture, but they didn't learn anything else. So that was the first thing, is they said, you know, you rescued us from this group, and then you abandoned us. And you know, that, of course, they were directing this to me, but in reality, they were talking about the me or the we as the system, because in the courts, we demanded that they receive psychological counseling. The problem was the courts put that responsibility on the parents of these 10 and 11, 12-year-old children to get them to counseling, and the parents were believers in the cult. So the first thing they did was say, that's stupid, this is worthless, and over time, they completely disenfranchised the children from any kind of counseling opportunities. The second thing was, they said, the only thing that's important is God, and the parents have all maintained this kind of extreme belief system, even though some went to prison, some did not. And so we saw these children who, in some cases, only got a third grade education and never had opportunity to really move ahead. So that was another complaint, is we had no way to get healthy. And then when we did talk to psychologists and therapists, they didn't believe what we had to say, because they just said nobody has gone through that kind of trauma. These are even the psychologists that they're talking to who are doubting what they did. And so they said, you know, you failed us when it came to psychological counseling. You failed us when it came to an education. And you failed us by stopping too soon on the investigation, which... all I could do is say, you're absolutely right. And so I called the county attorney that I worked with on this case, and I said, here's what I've learned. And he was as impacted as I was, that while we did the right thing, we didn't do the right thing well enough. We only did it within our realm, which is law enforcement. We satisfied the demands of the criminal justice system. We didn't satisfy the psychological needs or the educational needs. And so we got together and went to the governor's office, and we got with the Victims' Rights Coalition, and we said, here's the deal. These kids back then were guaranteed mental health counseling. They never got it. 30 years have passed. Is there anything we can do? And I'm so proud that the state of Utah said, we will pay for their counseling today, and we will honor a commitment that we made then that we didn't realize fell apart and broke. And so the first thing we did is we got the kids together, and we brought on the director of the Victims' Rights Council for the state, who told them, we will help you find a therapist that deals with ritual crime, and regardless of where you are, including one who is currently in Germany serving in the military, we will pay for your counseling. That was just overwhelming to me and to them. And then I got with my friend who is the president of Weber State University, a really well-known university in America. And I said, here's the deal. Here's what happened to these kids. And the president of the university got on this conference with these kids, and he said, here's our commitment to you. We will help you get an education, whether it is a GED, which is the lowest level of high school education, or if you want to get a PhD, we will help you make that happen. And we opened the doors for them to now get an education. And some of them have embraced that and are working on that. And so, in kind of a weird way, we, number one, we answered the question about counseling. Number two, the education. And then the third was we believed them. And we felt like writing the book would help tell their story. And that's the only purpose for that book, Andrew, was because the kids said, will you please tell the story? Because my wife and I just didn't think it was a story that should be written and told. It was just too disgusting. And so we wrote the book in a way that acknowledges that serious sexual crimes occurred, but we don't get into the seedy side of what happened and the ugliness. What we do is we talk about cult behavior. We talk about recruiting tactics. We talk about the actual raid, which was 70 police officers hitting all these homes at once. We talk about the semi-automatic weapon stashes that were found and the food storage and the medical supplies and all of those things. But we stayed away from making this a sensational thing. And then we did one other thing that I'm really proud of, and then I'll just quit yapping. And that is we decided that this was a book that the proceeds should not benefit us personally. And so we committed the proceeds from the book Deceived to go to helping build a children's advocacy center, a place where law enforcement and medical staff and others can come together to care for children of assault. And then also beyond that, to educate police officers. And so we make donations to Weber State University to help train police officers in investigating sexual crime.
Well, if that's not a reason for listeners to reach out and get hold of Deceived, then, you know, and I'll put links everywhere as well. I can see, are you getting emotional thinking about it now, Mike?
Yeah, I love those kids.
Oh, God. Well, I'm so pleased that you did what you did, and you're still doing so much for them. So, yeah, fantastic. Hey, tell me about, I want to hear, you were telling me when we last spoke, and I don't know the details about it, because you were just telling me after we got off the phone, there was a story about some sort of weird cult you were investigating, and then you went back once you'd retired much later and spoke to someone. Do you know what I'm talking about?
So many people, if you look up Warren Jeffs and the FLDS, which is the Fundamental Church, it was a spinoff of excommunicated Latter-day Saints back in the 1800s that formed their own religion. And Warren Jeffs ended up in a huge raid in Texas. He was arrested. 400 children were taken into protective custody in that case. This was a church of over 10,000 members in a closed community that, I'll tell you, when you drove into, the only people that lived in that community were members of the cult. So you think about my little Zion Society case and 14 houses committing crimes. This was 10,000 people in a community that spread from Utah into Arizona across borders. And they did that intentionally so that in the old days, when the state police would come to do raids, they would just move everybody across state lines to the other state. And back in those days, before the federal government really got involved in these kinds of investigations, you could get across the state lines and avoid a lot of enforcement efforts. But I chased these predators for years and years and years. And the prophet of this group and the prophet before him and the prophet before him all had one individual who was the bodyguard and was charged with all of the security to keep anyone that would threaten the prophet away. This guy was my nemesis. He hated me and I hated him. And it was a constant battle of me trying to get into the community to learn about child sex abuse and arrest people, and him trying to keep everything hidden away. Well, eventually, this person, Warren Jeffs, went to prison. He'll spend the rest of his life in prison. The cult started to break apart, and many of the members have left over time as the members became aware of all the sexual abuse. I have a home down near Zion National Park in Utah where I live. We live in northern Utah, but we have a home that we go to in the wintertime. And one day I just got this wild hair, and I called this bodyguard, his name's Willie Jessup, on the phone, and I said, I don't like you, and you don't like me, but I want to stop and talk to you. And he said, I'll give you 15 minutes. And we ended up spending 7.5 hours together. And in that time, we're not friends. We probably never will be friends. But in that time, he came clean on a whole bunch of things that were going on. He clarified some of the ghost stories that we believed that weren't accurate. But if people get a chance and can go to Profiling Evil on YouTube and look it up, you'll see where he took me to the baby cemetery where so many infants died because of all of the inbreeding that goes on in polygamous groups. He took me to the farm. He took me to the church that held 5,000 worshipers, a place where federal agents raided and tried to capture the prophet, but he was successful in fleeing. And then he took me to the secret caves that we had heard about where explosives were stored and weapons were stored, and a place that, in his words, only 1% of the membership of the FLDS cult had ever been inside, and that most people didn't believe was true. And he, at the end of our visit, took me inside the caves and actually filmed me talking inside the caves for just a brief moment, but he wouldn't allow me to film him inside the caves. And we went back into the belly of the mountain that they had carved out. And it is just amazing. And again, a testament that these closed societies, and there are, in my opinion, two kinds of closed societies. There are generational cults that raise children to believe in an ideology, and those are difficult groups, like the FLDS, to break down. And then there are convert cults, like the Zion Society, that come together, and people have some semblance of what reality is before they get involved in the cult, and they're much easier to break down and to infiltrate.
Hey, why did the guy then, you say you're not friends and he only wanted to give you 15 minutes at first, so does he then sort of, he knows what went on, and does he stand by it? He's like, well, that's where my morals lie.
He actually never believed that Warren Jeffs was a predator, a sexual predator. And then after Jeffs was arrested, he learned the truth, and he actually turned federal witness and testified against the prophet. He then, and some people have challenged what the motivations were, he then sued Warren Jeffs and the FLDS Church and won millions and millions and millions of dollars. And as a result of that, he's tried to rectify some of the things that he's done over time. He turns one building and land into a plot of land. He worked out a deal and built a high school because there had never been a high school that the kids could go to that weren't FLDS. And the state of Utah came in and worked with him on getting teachers in there, and he gave that back. You couldn't shop in the community unless you were an FLDS member. He worked out a deal and built a grocery store that now is open to everybody. So he's trying to somehow cleanse his soul through this process, and he openly says that. And he actually took the prophet's home that he built for his 84 wives and turned it into a bed and breakfast called the Outlaw Inn. And he now runs a bed and breakfast there and is doing his best to somehow cleanse his soul. And again, like I say, we will probably never be friends, but we did find a level playing field to talk and to explore things. And it was pretty darn healing for me 20 years after the fact to go in and learn of the things that we were spot on with and learn about the things that were just ghost stories that were spinning our wheels.
Where do you want to send people? Profiling Evil, to get your book? Just give us a minute on that.
Yeah, just go to Profiling Evil. So if you're on the web, profilingevil.com. If you're at YouTube, just type in Profiling Evil and it should take you right to us. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, at Profiling Evil will get you there. If you're in the States, you can get a hardbound version of Deceived or some of my other books through the website of profilingevil.com, and you can get signed versions there. Or you can pay less and get the paperback version anywhere in the world at Amazon. Look for Deceived, an investigative memoir of the Zion Society cult. My most recent book, She Knew No Fear, which is about the 1891 murder of a woman who came from the UK and was murdered in the States. Happened to be my great-great-grandmother, and 130 years after her death, wow, I solved her murder. And then, of course, some of the other books that I've been privileged to write.
Very cool. Mike, you've been on the edge. Thank you for coming on.
Oh, thank you, Andrew. I value our friendship, and I value the work that you do. And folks, please come over to Profiling Evil to our series, Cults Among Us, where I talk with Andrew, and we explore some of the great work that you've been doing, Andrew. Thank you.
What a lovely man. It was a pleasure speaking with him, and you can really hear in his words, in his mannerisms, the way he speaks about it, you can really hear how much exposing the Zion Society cult meant to him and means to him, continues to do so. Read more about it by getting Deceived, an investigative memoir of the Zion Society cult, online, and subscribe to Mike's YouTube channel and podcast, Profiling Evil. I am on it myself as of mid-July, I believe, so do check that out. Thanks to my newest patron, by the way, Grant T. Last week was Jim R. Both of you are amazing for helping to keep this podcast running. You can all help as well on patreon.com/AndrewGold, and you'll get ad-free episodes there and occasional bonus segments there too. Please do keep reviewing the podcast. I've been stuck near to 300 ratings in the UK for a while now and want to get over that so it looks a bit more proper and professional, you know. So if you listen through Apple, give us a review, mate. The latest reviews are as follows. NYC Game Fun in the US gave 5 stars, wrote, interesting guests, empathetic interviewer. Andrew Gold's enthusiasm for his guests and genuine interest in a diverse set of topics makes this an excellent podcast. Thank you very much, NYC Game Fun. That was very nice to read. Got another one from Case File Fan, who gave 5 stars. They're in the UK, and they wrote, fascinating podcast. Thank you for it. It's varied and fascinating. Some really interesting guests discussing frequently controversial themes. The Red Rider in the US, thank you for your lovely comment. You gave 5 stars, and you wrote, the British Jordan Harbinger. I wish I had as many listeners as he does. Maybe one day. I'm a professional long-haul truck driver from Mississippi. That's my accent. I hope it's not offensive to anyone. I consume 7 hours of pod... Oh my God, it's bad, isn't it? I consume 7+... I always forget that I can't do it, and I try to do it again, and I can't. I consume 7+ hours of podcasts each and every day. Of course, yeah, long haul truck driver, that he's out on the road. Andrew Gold is one of my daily listens, as I am also catching up on older episodes. I love, love, love the edgy and interesting content on Andrew's shows. I also love hearing him discuss and ask questions from an extra American, i.e. British, perspective. If ever there was a British Jordan Harbinger, Andrew is him. Thanks for keeping me company on the road, my friend. Oh, that's so nice, isn't it? What a lovely thought that someone's a long-haul truck driver in Mississippi, which is a place that to me is very exotic and reminds me of all the old books I read, you know, Mark Twain and all that stuff, and that this long-haul truck driver who sounds like a very nice person called the Red Rider has got my voice just booming around the truck while he's driving. It's such a strange and such a beautiful thought, and it's something that podcasts enable. Really, really amazing. I love that. The last review, there's been a lot of reviews this week, so please do join on that. Like, get all these reviews. Sometimes they're on CastBox. That's the other place you can leave reviews. Apple is a great place to leave them, though. You know, it gets people into it. It makes the podcast look more professional. Wonder Woman Wannabe left one. Another 5 stars. United Kingdom, this was. They wrote, quality podcast. This has quickly become my favorite podcast.
fascinating interviews, and I love the curiosity over judgment vibe. Oh, thank you. I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I've been all, you know, a lot of you who are listening, you know, I can't stop mentioning that. I'm really into that idea. I love the curious, you know, that's why, you know, for example, today Mike is quite religious. He draws on religion and stuff. I'm an atheist. But, you know, the idea of being like, oh, snooty about it is ridiculous. And I just think, what a lovely guy. He's done some real good in the world. He has different views to me, and I'm curious about them. So thank you, Wonder Woman, for picking up on that. And that's all for now. But coming up are ex-Jehovah's Witness Tony Duchesne, someone from the Moonies cult called Faith Yen, and Yen is spelled Y3N, and Professor Peter Boghossian, a big name in the anti-woke ideology world. I hope you'll stick with me for those episodes and many, many more to come. Have a lovely day, and I'll see you soon.